Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Friday, January 24th. Hector students get hands-on biology lesson. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Gifted and talented students at Hector College Prep Success Academy recently dissected fetal pigs, an experience that high school and college students would usually get. Assistant Principal Reagan Paquette said students on a recent Thursday were 7th and 8th graders. Spanish and gifted and talented teacher Jackie Martinez said students don't get a lot of exposure to science in 7th grade. In 8th grade, they have to worry more about the STAR test, so they don't spend a lot of time with dissection. Quote, "We thought it would be a good involvement for the GT students to get that experience," Martinez said. Twice a week, Paquette said the GT students are split into two different groups. The GRIST group included 6th graders with some 7th graders, and the second group was 8th graders with the other part of 7th grade. Quote, "The 6th graders did the owl pellets, and 7th graders are getting to do the pig. They do different lessons throughout the year," Paquette said. The lesson was a special privilege for the GT students because Hector is more literacy-focused, she added. Martinez said it's something the students will always remember. Students got a diagram so they could see where the pig's organs are located. Deja McKnight teaches college and career readiness and girls' athletics, but is certified in science. She said the students were going to come back the following Thursday and study the pigs a little bit more because they were probably going to run out of time. Quote, "I think it's really awesome because whenever I was here as a student, I got to do this dissection, but we didn't get to do it until biology, which was the 9th grade year, so most of them will get to see this in biology. But they're probably not going to do a dissection because at the high school level, the classes are a lot more full, and so they may not have time to do dissections," McKnight said. McKnight added that she has some students who want to go into the medical field. Quote, "I was telling them that this is baby steps, but it's the first step you're going to take," she said. Emperatus Menez, a 13-year-old 8th grader, said she thought the dissection was really awesome. She said her father was a butcher for 20 years, so she was sort of used to it. Quote, "I've never done this," Menez said. "This is my first time. It's not as bad as I thought it was going to be." End quote. 12-year-old 7th grader Diego Lavario said the lesson was fun. Quote, "It is kind of gross, but you kind of get used to it, and it doesn't also smell that bad. It's not so bad," Lavario said. He added that he could see what was inside the pig instead of just what was on the outside. Joe Amaker, who teaches 8th grade science and college career readiness, said she thought the lesson would teach the students compassion because the pigs were living creatures. She added that it would also help the students learn what's inside of them, literally, because the pigs' organs are similar to humans. Ticket, weekend entertainment guide for the Permian Basin. Little Shop. The Permian Playhouse's first show of 2020 will be Little Shop of Horrors, February 21st to March 1st. Visit PermianPlayhouse.com for more on the show and the 2020 season at the theater. On tour, The Road to the Rodeo Tour, featuring the musical group Midland, is scheduled February 22nd at Dos Amigos. Visit dosamigos.com for tickets. Shrimp Fest, a benefit for the Ellen Noel Art Museum, is scheduled February 24th at the Ector County Coliseum. Enjoy a Cajun-style celebration with unlimited shrimp, music, and auction. General admission includes food and two drink tickets. Sponsor tables are also available. For more information, call the museum at 432-550-9696 or visit noelartmuseum.org. Jersey Boys Come to Town. Musical is on stage on February 5th. It's a musical celebration with the lyrics we all know. Jersey Boys has been called Too Good to Be True by the New York Post and has won both Tony and Grammy Awards. The show comes to town at 7:30 p.m. February 5th at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Tickets range from $57 to $97. The show is the story of the musical group The Four Seasons, which included Frankie Valli and Bob Gaudio, and how their group took the charts by storm from the 50s to the 1970s. A movie of the same name was directed by Clint Eastwood and was a hit in 2014. Songs include Sherry, Big Girls Don't Cry, Ragdoll, Oh What a Night, and Can't Take My Eyes Off of You. The Four Seasons were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1990. The musical's creative team comprises two-time Tony Award-winning director Des McAnuff, book writers Marshall Brickman and Rick Allis, composer Bob Gaudio, lyricist Bob Crewe, and choreography by Sergio Trujillo. The show's website does detail that it contains authentic, profane Jersey language and is recommended for ages 12 and older. The event is part of Broadway in the Basin. Other Broadway in the Basin events include An American in Paris on February 24th, Beautiful, the Carole King musical, on March 24th, Rain, Abbey Road, on April 29th, Waitress, on June 11th. If you go, Jersey Boys, 7:30 p.m. February 5th, Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Tickets range from $57 to $97 at wagnernoel.com. Midland Festival Ballet takes the stage. Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale will accompany ballet. Tchaikovsky and Johnny Cash? Sounds unlikely, but the Midland Festival Ballet has plans to present an exciting night of favorites, tributes, and collaborations including music from Tchaikovsky to The Man in Black. The production is scheduled at 7:30 p.m. February 8th at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. The Midland Festival Ballet website, midlandfestivalballet.org, details that the show features world-renowned favorite Swan Lake Act II, Arensky Dances, and brand new works Danzon, and you say, The Party Never Ends, spanning the genre of ballet from classical to contemporary. Midland Festival Ballet, founded in 1993, is a non-profit organization committed to bringing the beauty of ballet to the basin. The performance includes Arensky Dances, a neoclassical work by dance icon former Atlanta Ballet director Robert Barnett. This ballet features a series of classical duets and a piano score by Anton Arensky. The work was originally choreographed for the Atlanta Ballet and will feature a trio of musicians on stage with the dancers. Swan Lake Act II. One of the most famous ballets, Swan Lake, is a favorite around the world. Act 2 features the story of Odette, a princess doomed to live as a swan, and the well-known melodies of Tchaikovsky. Special guest artists will perform the featured roles of Odette and Prince Siegfried. Danzon, a premiere work choreographed specifically for Midland Festival Ballet, Katia Garza's Danzon bridges the gap between neoclassical and contemporary ballet with Latin flair. The syncopated rhythms and sultry tones of composer Arturo Marquez sets the stage for this exciting new ballet. You say, the party never ends. Set to the iconic music of Johnny Cash, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Laurie McKenna, and Robert Earl Keane, performed by local band Angel and the Badmen, this contemporary work is choreographed by award-winning local choreographer Pearl Wamsley. This performance is sponsored by the FMH Foundation, with additional support from the Arts Council of Midland, Odessa Arts, Permian Basin Area Foundation, Rhea Charitable Trust, and Texas Commission on the Arts. Additionally, this project is sponsored in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. If you go, Midland Festival Ballet's Iconic, 7:30 p.m. February 8th, Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. For tickets, go online at wagnernoel.com. Here are some obituaries and death notices that appeared in the Odessa American on Friday, January 24th. Billy Mark Hoskinson, age 89, of Lake Brownwood, left this world on January 21st. A visitation will be held from 6 o'clock to 8 p.m. Friday, January 24th, at Heartland Funeral Home, early, and the funeral service will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, January 25th, in the Pleasant Grove Baptist Church in May, Texas, with interment in Pleasant Valley Cemetery. Bill was born April 4th, 1930, in McGregor, to William and Florence Hoskinson. Bill is survived by his beloved wife, Patsy Ruth Hoskinson, daughter, Janice Kay, and husband, Ralph Carter of Abilene, sons, Douglas Mark and his wife, Lynn Hoskinson of Odessa, Jerry Lynn and wife, Sherry Hoskinson of San Angelo, Philip Ross and his wife, Linda Hoskinson of Odessa, Jeffrey Allen and his wife, Twyla Hoskinson of May, sister Mary Ann Gillum of Lubbock, 11 grandchildren, 22 great-grandchildren, and many nieces, nephews, and friends. Bill was preceded in death by his parents and a sister, Lucy Lee. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be made to the Pleasant Grove Baptist Church, 201 Farnham Market Road, 2273 in May, Texas, 76857. Memorials, tributes, and condolences can be shared with the family at www.heartlandfuneralhome.net. It is with sad hearts that we share with you the passing of Tracy Lynn Free on January 20th in Odessa. He was born on December 11, 1953, in San Antonio, to Melvin and Juanita Free. He is survived by wife Marilyn Free, sons Crispin Dion Free and wife Iona, Chantry Shea Free and Courtney Milo Free, as well as three grandchildren, three uncles, one aunt, sister-in-law Jan Dowell, brother-in-law Robert Wallace and wife Rebecca, cousin Jaime Montelongo, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by infant son Shannon Dane Free, parents Mel and Joe Free, brother Larry Free, sister Marcia Vila, father-in-law and mother-in-law, Robert P. and Laverne Wallace, brother-in-law, Tommy Dowell, and brother-in-law, Lou Wallace. A memorial service is scheduled for Friday, January 24th at 1 o'clock at the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses in Odessa. Funeral services are entrusted to Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory. Patricia Ann Stubbs, age 67, passed away at a residence in Houston on January 19th. Ann was born in Odessa on December 31st, 1952, to Leland and Alice Stubbs. Ann was preceded in death by her parents, Alice and Leland Stubbs, her grandparents, Bert and Catherine Tice, and numerous aunts and uncles. She is survived by her sister, Kay Macon of Odessa, her two nieces, great-nieces and nephews, and numerous cousins. Graveside services will be 1 p.m. Monday, January 27th, at Sunset Memorial Gardens, with Reverend Dr. Jimmy Braswell officiating. To sign her guestbook, please visit www.service@sunsetodessa.com. Galen W. Stark, age 80, passed away Wednesday, January 15th, in Bedford, Texas. A memorial service will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 25th, at Country Road Fellowship in Young County. Galen was born February 16, 1939, in Ponca, Nebraska, to the late Margaret Marie Trueblood Stark and Glendon Herman Stark. Survivors include wife Karen Stark of Bedford, sons Darren Stark Sr. and wife Joyce of Mineral Wells, and Aaron Galen Stark of Bedford, 10 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren, sister Shirley Summerton of Waco, brother Glenn Stark and wife Elaine of Derby, Kansas, aunt Marcine Clark, many in-laws, nephews, nieces, cousins, and friends. Galen was preceded in death by a son, Gary Stark, and a grandson, Darren Stark, Jr. Nathan Acosta Garza, age 23, died Monday, January 20th, in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. Westminster Presbyterian Church at 4901 Maple Avenue has scheduled the monthly food pantry from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the last Saturday of each month. Call 366-1321. The Odessa Chamber of Commerce will present the 2019 Citizen of the Year Luncheon honoring David Boutin from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. on February 6th at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Conference Center at 305 East 5th Street. Event sponsor, tables and individual seating are available. Register by calling the Odessa Chamber at 332-9111. Registration may also be made online. The Alzheimer's Association West Texas Chapter has scheduled a Healthy Living for Your Brain and Body Tips from Latest Research event from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. February 6th at the Medical Center Hospital for Health and Wellness Center, 8050 East Highway 191. Learn about research in the areas of diet and nutrition, exercise, cognitive activity, and social engagement. Hands-on tools will be used to help incorporate these recommendations into a plan for healthy aging. RSVP to westtexas@alz.org or call 432-570-9191. Registration may also be made online. Citizens have the opportunity to legally dispose of bulky unwanted items for free. A bulk item drop-off center has been established at the city's recycling center, 814 West 42nd Street. Citizens can drop off unwanted bulky items Tuesday through Friday between 9 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. and on Saturdays between 9 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. Accepted items include electronics, furniture, appliances, mattresses, and other large items that do not fit in dumpsters. For more information, call Solid Waste at 368-3509 or for Household Hazardous Waste, 368-3546. Go online for a complete list of accepted items. This is the medical advice column, To Your Good Health, by Dr. Keith Roach. Tests for COPD. Dear Dr. Roach, what tests check for emphysema? Are they the same tests for COPD? My age is 80. Answer. There are two main forms of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, chronic bronchitis and emphysema. The main risk factor is cigarette smoking, but there are other risk factors including a genetic condition, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S., and it gets a shockingly low amount of research money for such an important condition. Diagnosing COPD early is important in order to relieve symptoms, prevent hospitalizations, and improve the quality of life and survival rates. The diagnosis of COPD should be suspected when there are classic symptoms, shortness of breath, chronic cough, sometimes productive, wheezing, and fatigue all may be present. The diagnosis of COPD is usually confirmed by tests of lung function. Spirometry may be done at the physician's office, but formal pulmonary function testing in the lab gives a definitive answer. Testing is done only to confirm a clinical diagnosis. Pulmonary function testing is expensive and time-consuming and can lead to inappropriate diagnoses if done indiscriminately. Representative reads to Carver students. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Carver Early Education Center students had the book The Little Engine That Could, a perennial favorite, read to them by State Representative Brooks Landgraf Thursday in the library as part of National Reading Day. National Reading Day is meant to encourage younger children to read. Superior Health Plan partnered with Carver to commemorate the day by giving away free books. University of Texas Permian Basin First Five staff also was on hand. A news release from Superior Health Plan said that, according to Texas-based BookSpring, only 35% of public school students are at or above proficient in reading by fourth grade, and that drops to just 25% in Texas. Children from low-income neighborhoods face even more of an uphill battle, as about 48% of them know only one or two letters by the time they're in kindergarten, the release said. On the other hand, children who are read to regularly have greater language comprehension and larger vocabularies than their peers, the release said. Landgraf read to 40 to 50 pre-kindergarten students in the morning and was scheduled to read to another group Thursday afternoon. He asked them what they liked about the book, and the students said they liked that the little blue engine helped the little engine in the title get over the mountain to deliver food and toys to children on the other side, that it was about a choo-choo train, and that the children had toys to play with and good food to eat. He added that the train that helped was the smallest of the ones that came by, and the bigger ones thought they were too important. Landgraf said, "It shows you're never too small to help others, and if you believe in yourself, you can do anything." Quote, "The minds of children are so special, and I'm always impressed with how creative they are in their answers and how they're not afraid to share what their thoughts are. Unlike adults, they're not trying to mask anything. They can just be very honest with you, and that's refreshing to see," Landgraf said. Sherry Palmer, principal of Carver, said reading books to children is the first step in them learning how to read. Quote, "It's like anything else. You model riding a bicycle, you model walking, you model crawling, so when you see other people reading and enjoying it, then they know it's something that they want to do too," Palmer said. Superior offered books for different levels of readers, and the Education Foundation has its Bookworms program that provides a book a month for children. Quote, "I enjoyed it," Landgraf said, of reading to the students. "It was a lot of fun. There's always a good message in The Little Engine That Could, but the class was very attentive. Literacy is obviously very important. These students understand that, and it was just good to be here with them," end quote. Carver also had the Nursery Rhyme Living Museum on Thursday. Palmer said they try to have a big event every month. She added that if children know between 10 and a dozen nursery rhymes by 3 years old, that it's a good predictor of literacy health. Quote, "And it's pretty amazing how many kids don't know nursery rhymes," Palmer said. Landgraf said he learned about the nursery rhyme research just by talking to Palmer. Quote, "This is great. I learned on campus today how important nursery rhymes are for literacy development, and the students here are learning and having fun doing it. I think that's what makes it so special, but they get to display how excited they are about learning. I think that's great," Landgraf said. UTPB Nursing partners with Detention Center. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Students in University of Texas Permian Basin's Bachelor of Science in Nursing program will get a unique clinical experience this semester observing at the Ector County Detention Center. The program is aimed at about 22 fourth semester BSN students who will graduate in May. Diana Ruiz, Assistant Professor and Director of the Simulation Center at the College of Nursing, said she has taught the Population Health course for almost 2 years. Part of the course teaches public health core competencies and how they tie into the BSN essentials. Quote, "But an accompanying course that they take is the clinical component, and when I took over this course a couple of years ago, the clinicals were very traditional, so it was health departments and things of that nature. That's a great experience, but they're limited in how many students they can take, and they're also limited in what the students can actually do based on what the health department provides, so our students are actually having to travel out of town to go to other health departments to do some more hands-on care," Ruiz said. Ruiz, the faculty and instructors brainstormed to figure out how to meet the needs of the students and the community. Quote, "I think there is a lot of emphasis in healthcare right now to shift into the community and out of the hospital. As crazy as that sounds, we actually don't want people in the hospital. We want them to be healthy. We want them to be well in the community, and so this partnership really came from Jennifer and I brainstorming, what else can we do? Where are we going? What we can do that's innovative, and, of course, our didactic component talks about K-12 caring for vulnerable populations. That definition can be children, it can be the elderly, it can be those with disabilities, but it also can be the incarcerated population. We've never had that opportunity to do that, so we reached out, Ruiz said. The Jennifer that Ruiz is referring to is Jennifer Swenson, nursing faculty and clinical placement coordinator. Swenson has toured the detention center. Quote, "They assured me that the students would always be with their direct nurse. They would never at any given time be left alone. Everything is secured and locked, so once you leave toward the offices and back to the detention center where the inmates are kept, it's all locked doors," Swenson said. The inmates will be considered low risk and nonviolent. Swenson said the inmates also will be completely supervised. "There are several small exam rooms that are close together so the students won't get lost." The detention center said it could handle up to 3 students at a time, but Swenson said they are sending 2. Ruiz said the students' purpose will be to use the clinical skills they have learned in previous semesters. Quote, "These are senior students. These are 4th semester senior students, so they will graduate in May. The year and a half prior to this, they've learned these great clinical skills, and now they're going to kind of help those become a reality. They'll help the nurses in their screening, maybe assessing the inmates, helping the nurses if they need care coordination or resources for the inmate," Ruiz said. Continuing the quote, "Then they need to understand how we provide compassionate care to the vulnerable population. We are not here to judge. We are not here to blame. Really, as with any patient we provide care for, we have to set aside our personal beliefs, our personal opinions as to what may or may not have happened, and provide the best care for that patient, period," Ruiz added. Ruiz said everyone would go to the detention center at least once. Quote, "I think this is going to be a learning experience even for us as faculty. I don't know exactly what all they manage in the detention center. I know it's typically more acuity, things they can do, chronic disease management, diabetes, high blood pressure, things of that nature. But I think anything acute is when they would definitely send them to the hospital setting," Ruiz said. Swenson said inmates make a request if they're not feeling well, and the medical staff has a certain number of hours to respond. They also conduct tuberculosis testing. Ruiz noted that inmates are already vulnerable because they're incarcerated and they don't have the freedom to go to the doctor right away. Swenson said if an inmate gets a broken arm, they wouldn't necessarily be able to handle it in the detention center, so they would likely be sent to a hospital. Quote, "Within any setting, regardless of whether it's incarceration or in a nursing home or a mental health site, anytime you have a large group of people living under one roof, if you will, sometimes even crowded homes, there's always that risk of tuberculosis. Right now, we are in peak flu season. That is definitely a concern. I think that's another objective that these students can look at," Ruiz said. Ruiz said the visits will be observational since, quote, "it's our first time to dip our toe in the water," end quote. Students have to keep a journal and write about what they saw that day, how it made them feel, and whether it advanced their skills. Quote, "It's going to be a really neat semester for us. We're really excited about it," Ruiz said. She added that students are required to take part in the detention center observations. On January 7th, Ruiz was on the city council briefing agenda to discuss a partnership with the city of Odessa with code enforcement. Jordan Sosa, clinical instructor for public health, said students will have the opportunity to go on ride-alongs with code enforcement. Quote, "What they'll get to do is see the different systems that are in place to keep the city healthy as a whole. This could be code requirements for buildings, safety environments for restaurants, things like that. It's going to be very much a day in the life. They'll get to go with a code enforcement officer and see the things that they monitor throughout the day, so every student's experience will be different depending on what's going on in the city that day. Hopefully, it will be varied and they'll get a lot of good experience," Sosa said. The connection to public health is that it takes in the health of the entire community, not just one person. Sosa noted that there are programs in place in the community that can assist people with obtaining things like running water. Quote, "It's very much all the way back to the stem of health as a whole. Your access to resources, the safety mechanisms that are in place to make sure we don't have any bugs in our water or anything like that," Sosa said. "It's very much different from traditional nursing. It's just all the way back to the stem of what could cause problems and a proactive way to prevent problems," end quote. Sabrina Williams and Emmanuel Wakisa, fourth semester Bachelor of Science in Nursing students, said they are excited about the detention center and code enforcement partnerships. Williams said her mom was a nurse in a prison for a long time, so she's interested to see what her mother went through. Her mom is a licensed vocational nurse in Fort Stockton currently. Quote, "I'm a little nervous, but I think you should talk to them like any other person. I think sometimes healthcare can lack in that setting, and I'm excited that we get to experience it and maybe work there one day," Williams said. Wakisa is interning at Midland Memorial Hospital and is from Kakamega in western Kenya. Quote, "I think it's exciting because we get to be part of the community engagement and we get to see the community part that we as students don't get too much of," Wakisa said. He said it wasn't a surprise that the students would get a chance to visit the detention center because, being an intern, he's seen some inmates come into the hospital. He said it will make him more empathetic to their needs. Wakisa said there are few nurses in Kenya. He said his aunt is a teacher at Odessa College, and he has an uncle who is a nurse. Quote, "So having the opportunity to come to UTBB to be a nurse was really mind-blowing because now I can achieve my goal and hopefully help someone else achieve their goal one day," he said. "I like to help people," end quote. Signs point to another legal battle brewing between the Odessa American and the city of Odessa following a crackdown by the city on releasing crime information. The OA, for decades, has received prompt response for requests for information about crime in Odessa, but that grinded to an almost standstill following a mass shooting in Odessa on August 31st. Some elected officials were unhappy the names of victims from the mass shooting were released quickly, and a shift in how information was released on all crime in Odessa began. Public documents that had taken 2 to 24 hours to receive began taking up to 4 weeks to obtain and often came back so highly redacted that it was unclear what crime had been committed. While the OA has been criticized in the past by city officials for, quote, "making the city look bad," by reporting the city's unflattering crime rates, this shift in releasing information violates state and federal law. Jeremy Halbrecht, CEO of AIM Media Texas, the OA's parent company, acknowledged that the city and the OA have locked horns before. Quote, "Here we go again with the city of Odessa, and one wonders why Odessa is the only municipality in the state of Texas taking this clearly illegal approach to the release of public information for the public's good." End quote. City officials say they have every right to delay or even withhold crime information from both the public and the media, while the OA and Freedom of Information experts say slowing down the release of crime information or not releasing it at all is a violation of the law. A recent meeting between the OA, CBS7, and city officials resulted in a plea for more time from those city officials and culminated Tuesday night during both a briefing session and an executive session of the Odessa City Council. During the briefing, Odessa Police Department spokesperson Corporal Steve LeSwear detailed how his job has changed in terms of how information is handed out. LeSwear said over the last 4 to 5 years, he would post the Daily Blotter on OPD's website and write press releases about certain crimes, but he said for all other probable cause affidavits, he would refer the media and the public to municipal court. Both the public and media were able to get those affidavits, which offer a wealth of detailed information about crime, by contacting municipal court. The process rarely took more than 2 hours to get the affidavit. Under the new process, the affidavits, when released at all, can come weeks or even a month after they are requested. LeSwear said all public records requests are now being sent to city spokesperson Devin Sanchez. Next, they are sent to city attorneys who have been routinely redacting, blacking out information that the OA and FOI experts argue is always public information. City officials have told the Odessa American that Odessa Police Department probable cause affidavits and incident reports are to be requested through the city's GovQA, which is the city's information website. Those probable cause affidavits and incident reports have taken up to 2 weeks to be released by the city and are often so heavily redacted that they don't make sense. This represents a sudden and abrupt change of city practice going back decades in dealing with how crime information is released to not just the media, but to the public. The Tuesday meeting's executive session ended with City Attorney Natasha Brooks addressing the 3 members of the media left at the meeting about enhancing material that can be provided to the media and better communication between the media and the city. Quote, "If you have any questions, I would like for you to contact me directly," Brooks said. "Assistant City Attorney Robert Carroll and myself are trying to vet everything. We ask you to work with us and give us time. You won't see things immediately change, but we do ask you to give us some time." End quote. "But the law is clear, and this is a violation," OA publisher Patrick Canty said. He noted that in his nearly 40 years in the business, he has never seen something so off the rails. Quote, "It's such a disservice to the public," Canty said. "This is considered the bedrock across Texas and the United States of the public's right to know." End quote. Canty said the OA is considering options including legal action again if this most recent violation of established law in Texas regarding public information is not remedied. "The challenge is not about just the media's access to information, but also the public's right to know about crime in the city in which they live," FOI officials said. The Odessa American made a recent request for a probable cause affidavit on January 8th and received a response from the city nearly a week later on Tuesday. Media law specialist and attorney John Bussian said 6 days is too long for the public to wait to see records they are legally entitled to see. In the past, the Odessa American received requested police records from the municipal clerk and often had those records in a few hours. Following the two meetings, some requests for information were answered sooner with fewer redactions. Freedom of information laws in Texas clearly state that basic police information must be released by police regarding an offense report or arrests. That information includes name, age, address, race, sex, occupation, alias, and physical condition of the arrested person, the date and time of the arrest, the offense charged, and the court in which it is filed, the details of the arrest, location of the crime, identification and description of the complainant, time of the occurrence of the crime, and detailed description of the offense. The recent change in how information is released to both the public and the media means that the city, in effect, has become a, quote, secret police organization that is no longer accountable to the public, FOI experts say. That's according to a spokeswoman for the Freedom of Information Foundation in Austin and Bussian, who represented the OA when it successfully sued the Odessa City Council 3 years ago for violating the Texas Open Meetings Act. Quote, "The city cannot just decide on their own that they are not going to release basic police information," said Kelly Shannon, executive director of the nonprofit FOI Group. Continuing the quote, "The police are not serving the public interest when they don't release the names of crime victims and other info that the public has a right to know. The best police departments understand that transparency is key to public trust. It's a bad thing for all of us when they operate in secrecy," end quote. Shannon said City Attorney Natasha Brooks was ill-informed about state and federal law and the First Amendment when she started making news organizations file FOI requests and wait for up to 45 days to get things like burglary reports and the names of murder victims and victims of serious felony assaults. Bussian of Raleigh, North Carolina, said, quote, "Secret police is a perfect description of the suddenly clandestine city." In the OA's 2017 open meetings lawsuit, the city was ordered to pay $12,500 of the OA's legal expenses in 2018 and to keep audio recordings of all closed-door meetings instead of written summaries, making it easier for the public to hold officials to account if future violations of the Texas Open Meetings Act seem apparent. Bussian said Brooks's recent arguments are full of holes because the city's new policy violates state and federal laws, including the TPIA, the U.S. Freedom of Information Act of 1968, and the First Amendment, which says, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances," end quote. Quote, "I don't know of any place else in Texas that withholds probable cause affidavits," Bussian said. The question goes back to Ms. Brooks. Where do these affidavits fit into this? It can't be under the TPIA, because how in the world is anyone supposed to hold the government accountable in obtaining the warrants served on individuals if the victims' names are withheld from public view? This removes the public from its historic role of overseeing the issuance of arrest and search warrants. It violates the TPIA and certainly violates the spirit of the public's right to know under the state and federal constitutions, is clearly wrong, end quote. Asked her rationale for the new policy, Brooks issued a statement, quote, "During an open records review, I realized that additional vetting by the legal department was required. I immediately requested that all open records requests be reviewed by legal to ensure the city was complying with the Texas Public Information Act. The PIA clearly states that confidential information may be withheld from public discourse under certain circumstances. The legal department has an obligation under the PIA to safeguard the confidential information of third parties, including but not limited to the victims of sexual assaults and juvenile information," Brooks said. "The city often releases a summary of the facts involving certain crimes to the media that does not contain confidential information through the police department's public information officer. We believe this information satisfies the legitimate public interest," end quote. Laura Dennis, editor of the Odessa American, said this is a complete misreading of the Texas PIA on the part of the city attorney's office. Quote, "The city attorney's office has no legal obligation other than to provide this vital information to the public. The OA has a decades-long policy of not publishing the names of sexual assault victims or information relating to juveniles. It has never been, and it never will be, the responsibility of the city attorney or the responsibility of the city of Odessa to withhold or safeguard this vital public information," end quote. OA reporter Bob Campbell contributed to this report. This is an editorial that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Friday, January 17th. District 2 residents must become more engaged. This was written by editor Stuart Doreen. Through 3 days of early voting in a special election to determine the next representative for Midland City Council District 2, the Midland County Elections Office has reported 100 ballots have been cast. That's it. I guess the positive spin on this news is that those who vote will have more of a say in who their representative is than voters in other districts. However, it is easy to see this voter turnout needs to turn around. District 2 is generally South and East Midland. For the next 6 weekdays, there will be an opportunity for eligible voters to select one of 3 candidates, John Norman, Adrian Urquidy, or Stephen Vallela. Election day is January 28th. I recently talked to an interested party about voter turnout in this district, and he expected a candidate might need as few as 125 votes to win. My jaw hit the floor. That is totally unacceptable. It doesn't matter if this is a special election. District 2 residents need to get engaged. Actually, residents need to get engaged. We hear at city meetings all the time about how respective areas are overlooked. It is hard to say whether there is any validity to those comments, but if there is, one can bet election turnout has something to do with it. In any one area of the city, there are 4 representatives that an eligible voter can choose: the representative of their district, the 2 at-large candidates, and the mayor. What does it say to that official if residents are so apathetic about their situation that they can't even bother to turn out and vote for leadership? During a pair of forums, the candidates were asked about what's going to be done about this or that. The candidates typically have offered their best attempt to say once he gets elected that he will work to make the situation better. The answer, however, really doesn't matter, because voters deciding to stay home effectively have handcuffed their elected representative and the amount of influence he can have. I would agree with anyone who believes an elected official represents all residents, including those who don't vote. But in the real world, there is a reason that elected officials typically knock on the doors of people who historically vote, rather than those with no history of voting. There is a reason that an elected body is more likely to react when they receive feedback on an issue. And it is my guess that an elected representative is more likely to err on favoring an area that is more engaged and politically active. District 2 residents, you have 7 days left to make your vote count. Get engaged, or you just might be left behind. Trade shows can boost business, allow consumers to shop around. This was written by the Permian Basin Better Business Bureau. The beginning of the year is a popular time for trade shows, and trade shows are great opportunities for businesses and consumers alike. For businesses, the shows allow you to display your products and meet potential clients face-to-face. Consumers are given the opportunity to shop around and compare different businesses in one place so they can find the one that best suits their needs. Trade shows can vary from home and garden shows to wedding extravaganzas, so no matter your business or what you're in the market for, there is a trade show for you. Use these tips from your Better Business Bureau to make the most of your trade show experience. For businesses, plan ahead. Give yourself time to prepare. Reserve your booth as far in advance as you can. Recruit team members to join you and determine strategy. Will everyone be at the booth talking to potential customers, or will you have someone walking the floor to network? Consider training your team members about how to answer FAQs about your business. Post on social media. Make the most of your social media presence to let your current followers know about the show that you will be attending. Post about it ahead of time and be active with your posting during the trade show so your followers can keep up with you. Social media is also a great way for new clients to connect with you after they leave the show. Offer freebies. Have items at your booth for attendees to take away with them. Free items will draw people to your booth and can be used as marketing if they have your logo, website, or social media info on them. Don't wait to follow up. Bring along a tablet, laptop, or other device you can document leads on. If someone is interested in your business or product, offer to take down their information so you can email them more information later. Don't wait too long after the show to follow up. Otherwise, the lead may have lost interest or found another provider. For consumers, plan ahead. Trade shows can be overwhelming for attendees, especially if there are too many vendors to see in one day. Check the list of vendors ahead of time and see if any of them require appointments. When you arrive, get a map of where each vendor is located, so you can easily find exactly who you're looking for. Create a budget. There probably will be opportunities to make purchases at the trade show. Decide ahead of time how much money you're willing to spend on which items and stick to your budget. Look for workshops. Most shows also have seminars and workshops to attend in addition to booths. Not only can this offer a break between vendors, but you may leave with tips or ideas from industry experts. For more information, contact Heather Massey, Senior Regional Director for the Permian Basin Office of Better Business Bureau, at 741-2592 or hmassey@permianbasin.bbb.org. DPS investigating MPD officer involved shooting. The story was written by Caitlin Randall. The Texas Department of Public Safety is investigating an officer-involved shooting that occurred in East Midland Wednesday night. DPS Sergeant Oscar Villarreal said troopers are investigating a shooting involving the Midland Police Department. He said he could not release further details at this time because it is an open investigation. Troopers had blocked off Pine Avenue at the intersection of North Fairgrounds Road as of Thursday afternoon. A house midway down Pine Avenue had crime scene tape in the front yard and a DPS vehicle parked in front of it. KOSA-TV reported a teenager and a three-year-old were shot during a home search. Villarreal said he did not know the ages of those involved in the shooting. Deanna McCandles said she and her family lived behind the house where the shooting occurred. She said she was playing with her children when she heard what sounded like a drive-by shooting at about 9:30 p.m. McCandles said her first instinct was to comfort her children, who, quote, couldn't understand what was going on, unquote, and locked the windows before calling the police. She said she'd heard 6 to 7 gunshots and what she believed was a car speeding away. An ambulance arrived at the home on Pine Avenue shortly after the shooting and quickly loaded someone inside the vehicle before leaving the scene, McCandles said. KOSA-TV reported the three-year-old, who allegedly was shot, had been transported to a hospital in Lubbock.
That's all for today's Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American, a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. You can also hear this program anytime online at recordinglibrary.org or by calling the telephone reader at 432-617-5555.